House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Tuesday, April 2nd. The first item on the agenda is being withdrawn, House Bill 3026. The City of Portland has asked that we pull that bill. Next item on the agenda is House Bill 3066, open a public hearing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3066 comes to you from Representative Barton. Allows a court to order a person subject to restraining order to wear a global positioning system tracking device to ensure the person does not enter an area the court has prohibited the person from entering, and basically requires the Department of Corrections to issue and monitor global positioning devices.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Brent Barton. I represent House District 51, which is East Clackamas County. Council Taylor has already summarized this for you, but this bill will create a program which will it'll give courts discretion to use GPS as a tool to track individuals who have previously violated restraining orders. In April 2007, 26-year-old Rebecca Grifo was shot and killed by her ex-boyfriend up in Seattle, the University of Washington. Her ex-boyfriend was named Jonathan Rowan. Rowan had previously threatened to harm her, and she had subsequently gotten a restraining order. Yet, none of this prevented him from killing her. This bill would essentially give law enforcement an additional tool, and it will also give prospective victims precious minutes and warnings so that they can potentially defend themselves. How this actually works in practice, the technology exists. It's, in fact, some iteration of this bill is currently used in 12 states, is that essentially a bracelet or anklet is attached to an individual, and if that individual goes within certain sort of designated no-go zones, such as around another individual's house or place of work, or perhaps, for example, a
shelter of some
sort, that automatically a phone call is made both to the police and also to the potential victim, so that the police can respond faster and that the victim can take time and precautions to try and defend themselves to the extent possible. So that is the bill as drafted. Unfortunately, it came back with a fiscal statement of approximately $700,000. It's quite a bit higher than I had hoped for. And so I'm going to work on some amendments to try and reduce that fiscal to the maximum extent possible. Let me give you just a few problems with the bill as is. First of all, well, the fiscal impact statement assumes, I believe, that all individuals who violate restraining orders will be tracked under this program. In fact, it's discretionary. It's not mandatory. Also, this currently applies to people who have been violated any restraining order. This bill is drafted. I'm thinking about amending that to apply essentially only to those who have been convicted of domestic violence crimes and done that. I think that will also significantly reduce the restraining order. Something I am concerned with, one problem that also amendment will have to work through, is many of the people, this bill requires them to pay, the person to pay for the service. Many of those same people also have child support payments, and I want to make sure that court order payment will not in any way interfere with their child support obligations. With that said, Mr. Chair, that is my intent, and I'm going to continue to work it. If there are any questions.
I had input about this type of bill from a Better Women's Shelter in Portland, and they asked that it be applied to people who are violent offenders, so that sometimes it may be the first time, but it's so violent that the woman's really in fear for her life. So if you would take a look, that may really blow the fiscal up. But Representative Olson.
Yeah, you know, generally, I appreciate bringing this bill up in front of us, Representative Barton, and I appreciate you too, your thoughts about moving it toward domestic violence. But I mean, a class A misdemeanor, which is your lowest of the assault, fourth degree of assaults, gets applied toward this. And just like what the chair is talking about, I think that makes sense too, to look at more of the the circumstances where it's pretty violent.
Representative Barton, thank you for bringing the bill to us. Good intentions. I'm thinking back a couple of sessions ago when we were looking at monitoring devices, and we were told the technology wasn't that great at the time, and also the problem is you've got to look at if you're using it in rural Oregon, there's no one to monitor. What's the monitoring system, or how does the system respond? So those are things you might want to look at as you're further researching the bill. Thank you.
I believe when we passed Jessica's law, that requires a tracking. So there's already a law on the books that requires tracking by parole and probations, and I don't know if you talked to any, maybe somebody's doing that already. Of course, those guys don't get out for a long time.
So
maybe that technology isn't being used yet. But just, I know that's part of that law that we passed.
We did just see an example of that use over in Vancouver where somebody had murdered a young girl, and they were able, although it didn't warn him ahead of time, but they were able to see he had been right there when they checked his tracking record where the girl was missing from. So but anyway, thank you very much. That's an excellent bill. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, as part of the intent of the bill, I don't know if this has come up before, but I worked in corrections for a short period of time, Department of Youth Services, and my job, part of my job was to check ankle bracelets of people who are on home arrest. And the and just in terms of implementation, where does this, you know, other states do this. Where did this go? Is it like part of an ankle bracelet? Is it a watch? Like, how, talk to me about kind of how it works and how that relates to cost and changeover from whatever we're already doing. I'm just curious, frankly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, Massachusetts was the first jurisdiction to do this statewide. I think they, I want to say that they did, they implemented it in, I want to say 2005, although I am not certain of that, and it has spread, some variation of it has spread against 12 different states, not necessarily all of them statewide, however. And yeah, it's typically is either an anklet or bracelet, and apparently, the actual underlying administrative costs, I'm told, are actually, it surprised me at how low they were and how the technology, it's not necessarily
to make sure they don't take it off.
One, I think, yeah. But that is a good question. I don't know the answer to the technical part of it. And Mr. Chair, and also members of the committee, I really appreciate the feedback. My staff is taking notes on all this. I will incorporate it. Just given the fiscal situation, and also given the substantive feedback I've received here, it strikes me as very unlikely I'm going to be able to get all that thought through, worked with LC, and back in time in a way that also lowers the fiscal, I think, to move it this session. That is unfortunate, but I suppose sometimes good law takes time. So this feedback has been very helpful to me, and I thank you for it.
Thank you. Gail Meyer, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We're actually neutral on the bill, but we did want to make out just a few comments on it. We thought that it was appropriately calibrated in that it did require first the setting of a restraining order on the defendant and then have the defendant actually violate that. It shows that you're quite a ways down the line in terms of inappropriate behavior, and that this was a calibrated and measured response to that. And there were times actually when we felt also it could be helpful for the accused to be able to show conclusively in front of a judge, I have been in compliance with this order and I haven't violated it. There were a few things. With respect to the first section, 4 through 8 or 4 through 7, there's no time reference of the duration of the requirement to wear the device. And these restraining orders kind of go on in perpetuity until the rest of your life, until something happens. And so would you have this bracelet on forever? We thought there should be some ability for the offender, for the person, to at least petition the court for an order to reconsider whether this needs to remain in effect after passage of a certain amount of time. And then also in Section 3, Line 18, when it talks about the court may require the person to pay all or a portion of the costs, we'd also like to have a consideration that based on the ability of the offender to pay, because there may be those who really do not have the means. It could be the difference between being in custody or out, and we just felt that provision should be in there as well.
Thank you very much for your input. That was helpful. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3066. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3077.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3077 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. It allows the surviving spouse of a decedent domiciled in Oregon at the time of death to receive a share of the decedent's estate first through an elective share process. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have a dash two amendments to the bill, which we got yesterday and are quite extensive.
Okay. Bernard Vail and Blaine Cheddarly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Cheddarly, good to be with you again this week here today in my capacity as chair of the Oregon Law Commission. For those of you who haven't had a Law Commission bill in front of you, just a few brief words about the commission. It was established by the legislature in 1997 to engage in a continuous program of law improvement and law reform. It has worked into just a really great partnership between the legislature and the executive and judicial branches on the one hand, and Willamette University College of Law on the other, which provides staffing and office support for the commission. The commission consists of four members appointed by the legislature, two by the speaker, two by the Senate president, a member appointed by the governor, four members appointed by the Oregon State Bar Association, the deans of the three law schools in the state or their designees, the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and the Attorney General. The Law Commission works through work groups that work continuously between sessions, drafting bills for introduction during the legislative sessions. Often we receive requests and referrals from the legislature for projects. Other projects come from the bar, from judges, from state agencies, and from the public asking us to take on a particular project. That is reviewed through a project committee, makes recommendations to the commission, and then if approved, the commission takes the project on, appointing a work group of knowledgeable practitioners to develop the legislation. And what you have before you today in House Bill 3077 is the product of that process of the Oregon Law Commission. I want to make sure there's no one behind me who's going to testify in opposition when I leave. Okay, it looks pretty clear. This bill seems arcane. It deals with the Oregon's spousal elective share. And I'll say something just very brief about that and then leave Professor Vail to spend a little more time on that with you. But Oregon has had a long-standing policy in its probate code against the absolute disinheritance of a spouse, at least without that spouse's consent. And for many, many, many years has had in place in the statutes a statute that gives a spouse who has been disinherited by a deceased spouse the right nevertheless to elect up to 25% of that spouse's estate, a means of protecting a spouse from being, again, disinherited against his or her will and without any notice or knowledge of that. That statute has been undermined over the past 60 or 70 years by the development of many non-probate forms of inheritance, living trusts, joint ownership, transfers on death, things that this statute just does not address. And so over time, the statute has become really undermined by these other ways of leaving property that has effectively rendered it almost without effect in protecting a spouse. So the purpose of this bill is, number one, to expand the types of assets and property against which that elective share may be made, and recognizing that duration of marriage might commend different shares, that is, spouse of a one-year marriage might have be in a position that's different than a spouse after a 30-year marriage. So this statute graduates that spousal elective share based on the term of the marriage. It sounds arcane, but I want to say in my closing remarks today that this bill is a product of 11 years of work groups and legislative sessions intervening. In fact, Representative Krieger, you may have heard this in judiciary before, it's made it to committee, but has never quite gotten over the hurdle. And I want to commend Professor Vail and Dave Hendricks, who's been with this from the beginning, and the Oregon Bar that has stayed with this project, recognizing how important it is. This session, to have made the final cut on the agreements that will support the policy and also work for practitioners and for estate planners and for their clients. And so we bring it to you today, I believe, without opposition. We are supportive of the Dash 2 amendments, which make technical and agreed-upon amendments. Again, my congratulations to Professor Vail for showing, in some respects, the tenacity of the Commission in staying at a project that is worthy of legislation and getting it to you at this session. So thank you for the opportunity to be before you today. I'll turn it over to Professor Vail and David Hendricks from Legislative Council, who has done the drafting on this for low these many years, are both here to further provide further testimony and answer any questions you might have.
Representative Barker, Chair, and members of the committee, this is a project that...
Could you say your name for the...
My name is Bernard Vail.
Thank you.
I am Vice Chair of the Oregon Law Commission and head of the work group that prepared this legislation. The project began when it came to my attention several years ago that some attorneys were recommending to clients that they file for divorce rather than wait until spouse died because of the ease with which a spouse could disinherit. The elective share, when it first came into being, was a replacement for the common law dower right that protected a surviving spouse, which was a life estate in property owned by a deceased spouse. And at the time the statutes were enacted, they were fairly useful because most property passed through probate, and therefore most of the assets of a decedent were subject to this election. Today, the reverse is true. It's often the case that the probate estate of a deceased person contains almost nothing, and the bulk of the assets pass through non-probate transfers, which are not covered by the current elective share statute. The result is that for a knowledgeable person, it's pitifully easy to disinherit a spouse. All you have to do is make sure there's nothing left in your probate estate. The only effect the current statute has is to provide an elective share for people who are either without advice of attorney or don't want to take the trouble to make non-probate transfers. I think the change is needed in Oregon because this is what started me on the road to this bill. I think it's very bad public policy for a state to be inviting divorce through the discrepancy between the rights of a spouse at death and the rights of a spouse in the divorce court.
Could you just kind of give us a snapshot of what this does? I mean, this seems a little strange to me, so...
Okay. What it does, basically, is it expands the types of property which are subject to the elective share. It encompasses a number of different types of non-probate transfers, such as revocable trusts, which are today one of the major estate planning devices that are used as a substitute for a will. In addition to expanding the scope of the property that's subject to the elective share right, it brings in a review of the surviving spouse's estate as well, because one of the traditional criticisms leveled against elective share statutes is that they ignore the fact that the surviving spouse may also have substantial property of his or her own, as a matter of fact, may have more property than the decedent. And it tries to equalize, as does the divorce statute, the property of the respective spouses. It phases in the elective share, starting at a low of 5% for a short marriage up to a maximum of 33% after a 15-year marriage, to answer another one of the major criticisms of traditional elective share statutes, which is that they institute the lottery theory of marriage, as it were. There was a case not too long ago where groom fell down the church steps walking out and broke his neck, and the question was, is the spouse entitled to the full elective share? And the court's answer was, that's what the statute says. So the lottery theory of marriage says pick a rich partner and hope they die soon. By contrast, community property provides that property acquired during the marriage is split between the spouses, and of course, in a very short marriage, there's going to be almost no community property because nothing's been acquired. In a long marriage, by contrast, almost everything the spouses own turns out to be community property and therefore owned by both. And this phase-in sort of approximates the result that would occur in a community property state. Those are the, I think, the major changes that are enacted in this bill.
So this would prevent somebody who, if they wanted to disinherit their partner, they can't do it. I mean,
that's not exactly true. That's not entirely true. There is no way that any statute can prevent someone who sincerely wants to disinherit a spouse and who hires competent counsel from doing so. There's nothing that can be done to stop someone from transferring all the assets they own to an offshore trust in the Cayman Islands. If someone really wants to do it, they can do it. What this will do is stop the ease with which the elective share can be overcome in Oregon and prevent what is, in essence, unintentional disinheritance that can occur because of failure to think about the fact that non-probate assets are being used.
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I may, too, this bill leaves in place, of course, the right of spouses through a premarital agreement, for instance, to agree not to exercise that elective share. So on a voluntary basis, it's entirely open to bargain between the parties. This deals with those situations where there's not been an agreement and trying to provide a greater level of protection for that surviving spouse from an intentional but less than perfect or an unintentional disinheritance.
Any questions? Representative,
I read this thing this morning a couple of times and somewhat understood it, but had some couple of questions. One is your Dash 2 amendment, Section 4 starts, there's a change there. What does that change do? Because when you go on to the second page of the Dash 2s, I don't see the percentages lined out the same.
I'm sorry, Representative Krieger, I'm not
sure I understand.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks from the Legislative Council's office, and guess I have been working on this a long time. The amendments don't replace the entire bill. It only replaces pieces of it.
Pieces
so
here and there.
The percentage things that are laid out in the bill are not touched by the amendments. They remain the same.
And just one other question, just as not maybe specific to this, but when you do have an estate, what happens now? 2 years, you have parting of the ways, or one of them dies. What about that part of the estate that was acquired prior to the marriage? Does that 5% include the value of all those things prior, or just what was accumulated during the 2 years they were married?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, the answer to that is that this structure doesn't look at when the property was acquired. It deals with the problem of the short-term marriage and the property that may have been acquired before by the percentages that are used in the table on the theory that even in the short-term marriage there's going to be some contribution into the assets. And after 15 years, you can go up to one-third. There was a lot of discussion over the years whether that should go to 50% on the theory that after a long-term marriage, it should be 50-50. Okay. The decision, the fractions we have here are based on, I believe Florida adopted this approach briefly. And I should mention, too, the table and a lot of this bill, it started out based on the Uniform Probate Code, who came up with this concept probably 15, 20 years ago, and that's where it started. It's changed a lot since then, but the phase-in over the period comes from the Uniform Probate Code as being the mechanism for basically making the decision about how much of the estate goes over.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, on that point, of course, so it does include property acquired prior to the marriage, Often, of course, that's exactly what drives people to premarital agreements, and appropriately so. But in this case, rather than assuming that aspect of an agreement where there has been no agreement, this bill incorporates or includes that previously acquired property as part of the estate.
Representative Garrett, please.
And you might have mentioned this, but just following up on that, this statutory change would not have any effect on prenuptial agreements.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we have a prenup, and then we have, if you get divorced, and we talked about the prenup, but how about when you divorce, does that nullify anything in here? And I guess I'd have to ask, has any member of the legislative body looked into trying to tax this?
Mr. Chair, Representative was going to ask the second question. I don't know. Damn. I'll say it was not in the comprehensive task force on revenue restructuring report. As to your first
Chuck
point,
Riley's on it.
As to your first question, of course, if you have the premarital agreement, then you have the divorce. The premarital agreement is carried out through the divorce. Once it's divorced, then the rights of inheritance are gone. So this statute would have no effect after a divorce.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, if I may.
Please.
First, let me preface them by saying I think it's reasonably well known that I enjoy obscure civil law more than most on this committee. And this bill is hardcore. I mean, it really was challenging to wade through it. My first question, would you have a copy of the bill in front of you? I just want to make sure I understand what the bill means. Look on page 4 in section 9, subsection 2. There's lines 17 to 19. For purposes of the subsection, consent by the surviving spouse to split gift treatment under federal gift tax law does not constitute consent to transfer made by the decedent. Can you explain to me what that means? I think I know what that means, but I have a hunch that's very important.
Representative Barton, under the current tax laws, a married couple can make gifts in excess of the $13,000 annual exclusion if both parties agree to treat the gift as though it were made half by each, so that one spouse can give, in effect, $26,000 annually to each donee of his or her own property, so long as the other spouse agrees, for purposes of filing an income tax return, that it's to be treated, or excuse me, a gift tax return, that it's to be treated as though made 50-50 by each spouse. The problem here is that there's an argument to be made that if a spouse consents to splitting gifts for purposes of saving taxes, basically, that they have somehow waived their right to claim that that gift should be counted as part of the elective share. And this section, lines 18 and 19, basically say that's not the case.
Thank you.
Consenting for purposes of saving taxes is not a waiver of your rights to property after death.
Thank you. And my second question, if I may, Mr. Chair, is actually the following page 5, section 13, which relates to property transferred within 1 year of death, how that counts as the decedent's non-probate estate.
The purpose behind section 13 was simply to prevent deathbed transfers that would avoid the elective share.
If I may, my question actually specifically was revolving, I understand the purpose. Why the period of 1 year, is that common? Did that come from somewhere? I immediately think of bankruptcy, a preference period of 90 days. It seems a very long period for...
Representative Barton, it actually started out in the federal gift tax code, estate tax code, with an inclusion in your estate for federal tax purposes of gifts made within 3 years of death. That's where the concept originally arose. It's been refined variously in various other laws. The Uniform Probate Code provides for a two-year inclusion period. Gifts made within 2 years of death are brought back into the estate for purposes of the elective share. The work group, after a long discussion over this issue, decided that 2 years was probably too long a period and settled on 1 year as being an appropriate period for inclusion of property in the estate. And the idea, of course, is simply to prevent evasion of the elective share. If someone, for example, is diagnosed with a terminal illness, well, the easy way to avoid the elective share is to start giving away property. and the work group felt that 1 year was an appropriate period.
That must have been a very interesting discussion, Professor. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Stigler.
Thank you. It's been a long time, Professor Vale. He doesn't know this, but he was my Wills and Trust professor way back in.
Oh, I know that. I may not remember the name, but I never forget the face.
Oh, now he's telling me after 30 years, my face hasn't changed. Really trying to.
Oh, that's really good.
No, I wanted to go back to what you were talking earlier. You talked about sort of the equalizing trying to get it more in equity with sort of the divorce stat, the whole idea of that to increase this up to the place that you did, the 33% was sort of to bring it in line with where it might end up in a divorce proceeding. Now, acknowledging we're not a community property state in Oregon, but I guess my question is, why then the 33%? Why not something above that on the graduated scale exactly, particularly when you're taking into consideration some of the things such as the property of the surviving spouse and those kind of things?
Representative Stigler, in many ways, it's simply a compromise position that came out of the work group discussion. There were people who felt that 50% was appropriate, and many states have gone that route.
Right.
There were other people that felt that that was simply too much, particularly in light of the fact that, as was pointed out earlier, that property acquired before marriage may be included in this calculation. It's simply a compromise position that balanced off the various viewpoints.
Mr. Chair and Representative Stevens, if I may, too, there, if you think of this in terms of the other hydraulics in the bill, starting in the position now where it's a 25%
right.
share of the
that.
Probate estate, the percentage is being increased to 33%. The estate is being expanded to include non-probate assets. So there are all these hydraulics. And I would bet that over the past 11 years, it bounced around from 25 to 50, and community property was even on the table for a while.
Yeah.
And so there's a history probably just about every percentage that you want to cut. And it seemed that in the context of all of those moving parts, that seemed to be the place where everyone was in agreement.
Everyone was comfortable with it, is what it amounted to.
At one point, Representative Stigler was even discussed throwing it all out and just saying that after death that the court would look and come up with a fair and equitable distribution with the language from the divorce statute. But what that does then is create so much litigation in every single estate that part of the impetus here was to come up with a hard number so that you could plan, A, estate planners could actually plan, and B, that you wouldn't have litigation in every single case.
And I appreciate that. I was just curious as to how, you know, why we hit upon that number, whether it was through a process of compromise or whether there was some hard and fast rationale for that number as versus...
It was basically a compromise position.
Okay. Yeah. But, I mean, it sounds like there was a lot of the underlying issues were worked through to sort of get to that position. Okay.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, panel. Oh, I'm sorry. Two more questions.
Not a question. Okay. I'd just like to thank you guys for the work on this. This has been a long effort, and the Law Commission does a great service, and it's a lot of folks who don't get anything out of it other than in the sense that they're contributing to the improvement of law, and it's a true public service, and I really appreciate your work.
Thank you.
One more brief question, if I may, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that essentially a predecessor of this bill came before this committee several years ago and did not make it through. I don't know, perhaps, Mr. Chair, if you were on the committee at the time. Can you tell me why it didn't make it through last time?
It was voluntarily withdrawn by the Oregon Law Commission because without any warning, we ran into a series of very serious objections from various sections of the Oregon State Bar, which had not surfaced during the work group process. And the Oregon Law Commission felt that although it might be possible to deal with those objections through an amendment process, the time constraints were such that the deadline was approaching, and the commission thought it simply more prudent to withdraw the bill than try and force it through in a contentious state.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
The amendments last night, so we do not have a fiscal, but we can adopt the dash twos.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move the dash twos in the House Bill 3077.
Representative Wisnant moves the dash twos into
House Bill 3077. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Representative
Can Clear. You explain the dash two?
No, but no, when you carry the bill on the floor, you'll be able to explain it.
I'll carry that's sort of like Representative Smith, you know.
Consent calendar after 11 years of work.
All right.
You like him driving a patrol car.
No objection. So ordered. Close the public hearing, the work session on House Bill 3077. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2664.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2664 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, and Craig Prenz allows the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to apply for and receive gifts and grants, award grants, enter into contracts to purchase goods without involving DASP.
Council, members of the committee, I'm Craig Prenz. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. I think Mr. Taylor described pretty well this bill, House Bill 2664. It basically, Department of Justice suggested we get this language to make it clear that we can apply for and receive grants from any public or private source. We are planning on becoming the state administering agency for the federal JAG grants that are part of the that was a decision that the governor had made before the stimulus package and all those things happened, to shift that from OSP, Oregon State Police, to ourselves to be the administering agency. And when we talked about that with the Department of Justice, they said that it would be good just to make sure it was clear in our basically our operating statute that we have the ability to apply for those gift, those grants. That would be basically subsection 5 A and B, and then subsection C has to do with then the contracts that we would enter into for things like the that arise out of the grants or other contracts. Typically what we contract for are things like research grants, research and evaluation of programs. So that's what the genesis of what 2664 was, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions?
This one, Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrett.
We have are any other states boards or commissions exempted from the normal rules of purchasing that your commission will be exempted from under this bill?
Chair and Representative Garrett, good question. I think the answer is yes. I've talked to DAS and the procurement folks that have these statutes, and my understanding is this language was lifted by DOJ from another agency. So I think the answer is yes.
So and there is precedent for this?
There's precedent, and I've talked to DAS. We think, to be really honest, it's more complicated than I realized, and we're working through it with DAS. I'm going to meet with them, no matter what you all do with the bill, if you move it or don't move it or whatever, I'm going to meet with them and continue to meet with them to make sure we understand. But yes, there's precedence for this, and what we would do then is we would establish that we would follow. The Department of Justice has their own rules on what that we do. They incorporate part of the procurement statutes that are exempted here. And so short answer is, yes, there is.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Mr. Chair, I would ask that we not move this bill today, and I'd like to have further information, a lot more detail than I've received today, or than the bill on C, second page, 7 through 10.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, can I comment to Representative Whitten? I appreciate that. And the genesis of this was the kind of contracts we enter into are not procurement of computers and things. They're generally research and evaluation contracts. And so I completely understand if you want to hold off, and I'm going to meet with the folks at the DOJ folks that suggested we do something like this, and the folks at DAS to make sure I can vet more fully what exactly we're doing, what would be the rules that we would go forward with if we did this. So I appreciate your reticence.
So I thank you for those comments. Up to the chair, but I do have some concerns, and I'm not sure if you want to. No, I think it'd be more productive time to do it off.
That makes a good. You make a good point, and since Mr. Prinz is going to be getting more information, it seems like.
Thank you.
It'd be better to have you satisfied before we move it then.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Prinz.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2664. And open a hearing on House Bill 2665.
Chair, members of the committee, this bill also comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, approves regulations adopted by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, their regulations are different than the most others in that after every legislative session, they go through and evaluate what we've done as far as bills that increase sentences or decrease sentences, and then they adjust their sentencing guidelines to reflect what the legislature did, and given that relationship, they are then required to come back and have these regulations approved by the legislature.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Craig Prinz from the Criminal Justice Commission. Bill's right. This is, for those of you who are new to the committee, the Criminal Justice Commission was created in 95, and our predecessor was called the Criminal Justice Council. Criminal Justice Council was basically the folks who worked with a sentencing board in basically starting in 85 and then getting adopted in 89, the sentencing guidelines, that in 95 we became the agency that administers the guidelines. And I should point out, for Representative Olson is one of my commission members, as well as so is Senator Przanski. So in our statutes, ORS 137-667, it says that after, so here we're talking about the 07 legislature, y'all create new crimes, amend current crimes, same as you're doing this session. At the end of the day, when the dust settles, we look at all those amendments and changes and new crimes, and we work with the commission to determine where they would be on this vertical axis of how serious are they, from one being a simple drug possession to 11 being a murder. So that's what we do on, as far as your work. We can also, in our own discretion, recommend amendments to you all. Those are not operative law unless you approve them. And so there's kind of the reacting to the last session. That's what we do every session. There's the discretionary ones that we're recommending to you. And then this session, and this one, there's also one that deals with Measure 57 that was passed, you know, through the initiative process. So I wanted to go through each one real briefly to explain them to you. And to say also, sentencing, as you probably learned this last 3 months, is incredibly complex in Oregon. We've basically moved through the last 20 years with the guidelines of having a lot of statutory laws as well that make it complicated. The guidelines, I would say, are the basic rules of how sentencing works. Even with the things like Measure 57 or Measure 11, those become the thing that govern who goes to prison more and more. But this is kind of the nuts and bolts rules of the way sentencing works in Oregon, is what the guidelines have become. So, Mr. Chair, if you want, I could real briefly go through what these are. I can be there. Basically, I'm going to go through the reactions to 2007. There was legislation in 2000 that created a new crime of subjecting another person to involuntary servitude. Mr. Taylor and the committee members that were here last session might remember that was part of the human trafficking. We set that as a level 9 if the offender caused or threatened to cause death or serious physical injury, and a crime category 6 if there was a restraint or of a person or a threat to restrain a person. So basically, we're recommending that the first one be here, and it be a 9 if there was a threat of death or serious physical injury. The next the next in the series on your bill. So that's this adoption of OAR 213-18-0068. The next one is on line 7 of your bill, 213-003-0001. That's basically our definitions rule. And so what we have to do as far as your new crimes or admitted crimes with definitions is basically determining if it should be a person felony or a non-person felony. And so there's a couple of things we've done there. Again, you'll see in my written testimony, we're saying that subjecting another person to involuntary servitude, 1 and 2, and trafficking and persons, which were all kind of related as a package last session, should all be characterized as person felonies. Aggravated vehicle and homicide, which I believe the chair sponsored last session, should be treated as a person felony. Luring a minor has to do with the computer work about sexual predators using computers, should be a person felony. Purchase or sale of a body part for transportation or therapy, I didn't come from this committee. I doubt we'll ever see a conviction for that. It basically has to do with altering a document of a gift so you can get the body part. We thought that should be a person felony. Online sexual corruption of a child, 1 and 2, are also part of that package that came last session regarding sexual predators using computers. Mr. Taylor worked on it a lot. It was basically taking all the case law we had about what was constitutional and what was protected, changing some laws, creating new ones. We thought those should be person felonies. And furnishing sexually explicit material to a child should be classified as a person class A misdemeanor. Those are all reactions to the 07 legislation that part of them you all had a part to be in it. The other amendment to that bill is a clarification of what a straight jail sentence means. A straight jail sentence is where a judge on a probationary sentence says, I'm not going to try to do probation again with this guy. He's tried many times. We're just going to give him 15 days jail or 20 days jail or whatever they want to do. The commission thought it was clear that you don't follow that with a supervision afterward, but we wanted to clarify it better, that is permissible under the guidelines. And then the last definitional thing is a discretionary change that we are recommending, having to do with aggravated animal abuse in the first degree and felony animal abuse. The commission heard testimony about these two crimes from Heidi Moad that came down from Portland, and basically there's a lot of literature that folks that what we're talking about here is intentionally torturing animals, that's a real bad precursor sign to someone who's going to get involved in violent crime against persons in the future. So after hearing that testimony over the summer, the commission drafted the rule that would change that from a non-person to a person crime. So that's kind of the definitional stuff. I'll just continue. If you all have a question, let me know. I know this is kind of dry stuff. So that's the amendments that would be on page line 7 of the bill in 213-003-0001. The next two rules that we put in, I'm going to actually ask Mr. Taylor that I think we need to amend those, delete those two, because we didn't end up making those changes. And so the next one that we are asking you to adopt is in OAR 213-017-0002. Again, this is aggravated vehicular homicide that the chair, I believe, sponsored last session. And that's just setting that as a crime category level 10 on the guidelines. And I'd be happy to explain any of the elements of that if the chair would want me to. The next one is then amending OAR 017-0003. That's line 8 of your bill. This is just the ones I already mentioned. We already talked about we're going to make them person crimes or non-person crimes. Now we're just saying where should they be on this axis, and we're recommending a 9, as I said, for that. The amendment in 017-0004 places online sexual corruption of a child at an 8 and aggravated animal abuse as 1 as an 8. The amendments to 017-0006 you can see in your testimony, classifies mail theft. This is the one that I had mentioned. It's from Measure 57. In Measure 57, we took mail theft that used to be a misdemeanor and classified it as a crime category 6. The testimony that the commission heard was basically, as you probably know, most thefts you go by the value of what was stolen. But with mail, it's not really the value of the paper, it's the value of the personal information that's in that mail. And so they recommended, the commission is recommending, and asked me to adopt for your approval that it be a crime category 6. Felony animal abuse 1, we're recommending that you enhance that from a 3 to a 6. And then there was also legislation in 2007 of a criminal possession of a rented or leased vehicle. This didn't come through Judiciary Committee. That we recommend that be treated just like every other property crime, where it goes by the value of the stolen, here it would be vehicle, so a level 6 if it's a very, very expensive vehicle. Online sexual corruption of a child and luring a minor, also level 6. Mr. Chair, then we go into 017-0007. We're continuing to just set in the rules basically the crimes I've already mentioned as at what crime category they should be based upon the value of what is taken and these criminal possessions or this kind of esoteric body part transplantation. And you can see in the last page of my written testimony what we would be doing in those last four amendments. 017-0008 we're classifying as the crime 4 category, organized retail theft, alteration of a document, criminal possession of a motor vehicle where it's this value of more than 5 but less than 10. And then in 017-0009, the amendment is basically deleting felony animal abuse and aggravated animal abuse as crime category 3 because we are elevating those to the ones I mentioned previously. And then it's just also dealing with the motor vehicle, possession of a rented or leased motor vehicle with certain values. Same in the last two. You were just basically treating that like every other property crime. So those are the amendments to the rules that are here for your approval. In past sessions, we have not had anything but the reactions to the last legislature. This time, because we are in our own discretion recommending a couple things to you, that's basically the straight jail and elevating the animal abuses. We did get a fiscal. I think Enola gave it to the committee. You have a small fiscal, and I know that. So that's our bill for you. And I know that Gail Myers wanted to make to speak to it about how it's laid out mechanically. So,
Mr. Friends, you and I had a discussion earlier with Jess Barton.
Yeah.
And we talked about getting an amendment that would incorporate all of these regulations verbatim.
Right.
In the statute. Is that still intent? And do you want to explain to the committee why?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Taylor, I basically was going to, Jess isn't here, but Gail was going to speak on his behalf. So I think what...
Go ahead and repeat what he was going to say.
Okay. Yeah. So Jess Barton is a real good appellate defender here in Oregon. He's kind of written the book on the guidelines. And he had an argument that he made, and it's in a Court of Appeals case called the Norris case, that basically that we should not put our guidelines before you like this. We should write them out longhand because there's a section of the Oregon Constitution that says an act of the body has to be set out longhand, and I should have brought the case. Jess failed on that argument. The legislature said that while we're saying that these rules are unique in some ways, they have the force of statute and they have to be approved by the legislature, that doesn't mean they are an act or a statute. Jess brought to my attention, and we were set for hearing, I think, a few days before, a new case came out called State versus Pemberton, which came out on March, always like 2 or 3 weeks ago. Jess felt that made his argument stronger, and it actually has to do, believe it or not, with the sliming bill. I don't know what you guys call that, the bill where it talks about if a public safety officer, someone spits or gets a dangerous substance on them. There's a section in that statute that says if you commit that crime, you must go to a state facility. That we put in our rules to explain that you go to the state facility even if it's less than 12 months sentence. So it would kind of be, the judge was grappling with, I've got 1145, the statutory law that says no one goes to state corrections unless it's 12 months and a day, versus a rule that says no, it doesn't matter the length of sentence, you still can go locally. The Court of Appeals said the rule governed, which is kind of unusual in that the rule is governing over the statute. And so Jess felt that made his argument better, that we should do it longhand. It's been done once before longhand in 2003. I think Jess made the same argument to Phil Lemon, my predecessor, and Phil, just to be safe, basically had LC draft it longhand. And so I've already talked to Josh Nasby about that. I just wanted to let you all know. I don't think Jess is right, personally. I think the Norris case prevails, and they say, when we say it has the force of a statute, we're not saying it is a statute or an act. But, you know, it's kind of one of those, if you want to be better be safe than sorry type thing, I can just have them all drafted longhand. So that's kind of what Jess was going to speak to, and I don't know if you want to ask Gail or myself about it.
Representative
Stigler. Yeah, just a question. I'm assuming, Mr. Prince, when you're referring to longhand, you mean spelled out in statute.
Yes.
Yes.
So it's basically right. Would look more like to you like a bill. It would lay out.
Would incorporate.
That's right.
Rather than a summarization, it would
that's
incorporate
right.
The sort of verbatim.
That's exactly
line
right.
After line. Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Chair Barker, and members of the committee. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, I am articulating really here concerns of Jess Barton. And he had attempted to be here personally. He was tracking. This is the second setting or the third setting of this bill. But just to let the committee know, the logistics of this is problematic for Mr. Barton because he does like to follow these. He does write the manual on interpreting the guidelines. And so when the bill is written in this form, there's nowhere to really look at it and know what it is the legislature is intending to do. And so he had to schedule time with Mr. Prinz and go over them piece by piece. So, yes, it is his position that if the guidelines do have the act and force of a statute, that they should be set out in text.
It's my desire that they be set out in text. The slight expense of doing that now would be overwhelmed by any future litigation, and
yeah.
I'd just rather have it come in clean
yeah.
And fixed okay. To begin with.
So.
Okay. Any further? Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2665.
Okay.
And open a work session on House Bill 2655.
Mr. Chairman, please. 2655.
It's the crime act.
Chair members of the committee, House Bill 2655 comes to you prohibits a person from attaining the property of a mass transit district by adverse possession. It comes to you from the Committee on Judiciary. We had Olivia Clark testify on behalf of the bill the last time. It has no revenue, no fiscal impact. It would just, as I said, prohibit someone taking property by adverse possession. It's all ready to go, Mr. Chair members of the committee. We are in work session.
Mr. Chair, yes. I move the committee send House Bill 244A 2655, I'm sorry,
okay.
To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2655 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Seeing them take the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Excused.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carried.
Consent.
Yeah,
is there any objection to putting that on the consent calendar?
Okay, consent. Mr. Chair, I hate to do this because I've learned that whenever I do so, I end up carrying it. But I do think that there's some legitimate issues that some may want to think through on the floor.
Okay. I agree this could have some questions, and I also agree that Representative Barton would be a great
safety gear.
Representative Barton, yeah. Thank you.
Sort of like the Mutt and Jeff show or something.
He'll learn. He's taking longer to learn than I thought he would.
Yeah. I thought about it. I thought about just letting it go.
Open a work session on Senate Bill 2448.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 2448 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar, increases the size of the Board of Bar Governors, the Oregon State Bar from 16 to 18 members. Allows the board to establish special permits shorter than the 4 years of person's 4 year term currently in existence for the purpose of staggering the terms of members of the board. It includes public body and limited liability companies when the term person for the purpose of unauthorized practice of the law. Chairman of the committee, the amendments to the bill, it's where I believe it.
We adopted the dash five.
I think
five.
We adopted think the last five. Time.
That's what I've got.
Yes. Increased the size of the board starting in 2011, not 2010, and also removed some provisions relating to the solicitation of personal injury claims. Has a minimal fiscal impact, Mr. Chair. And we have the revenue and fiscal statements.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 244A. To the floor as amended with a due pass.
Representative Stigler moves Senate Bill 244A as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Excuse.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Stigler?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excuse.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Garrett will carry that one. Is there any further business to come before the committee?
Chair, members of the committee, if I could just remind the committee about the memo that was sent out. Yeah.
You may. I put out a memo regarding what needs to be done as we run for the finish line here. And so everybody has a copy of that. Self-explanatory. Meeting adjourned.